Sup, fools? Today's trip down the rabbit hole is brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people that donate a monthly recurring sum to help support the podcast and keep me in business. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. I want to shout out some of my patrons. Get that all over with here at the front of the podcast so we have an uninterrupted and generally badass interview after that. First and foremost, I want to shout out my friends over at The Trader's Path. Pete at The Trader's Path started his own day trading service. If you sit at home and you day trade all day, you're looking for watch lists, you're looking for scans, you're looking for a live stream of what Pete's team is doing every day. He trades in red markets, green markets, options, equities. Pete has been trading for a long time and used to be a former member of other day trading services until he found out they were all bullshit. And then he said, I'm starting my own, with a focus on the people that sign up. Instead of trying to take advantage of them, like a lot of other day trading services do, they want to collect their money and they could give two shits about whether or not they front run your trades and things like that. Pete said, I'm going to do things different. He said, I want to do something that's about the traders themselves. So a great place to get news for the day, names to watch, education. The link to Pete's service is in my podcast description. Check it out. He loves QTR podcast members and he loves the podcast and we love Pete back. So thank you for your continued support, Pete. I also want to shout out my friends over at the Sanglucci Steam Room. My homeboy Sanglucci was the last podcast. We just did a banger about blowing up your trading account. So if you want to get to know Sanglucci a little bit better, listen to the last podcast. For those of you that don't know him and don't want to listen, what does Sanglucci do? Well, he does a couple of things. He runs the Steam Room all day, which is an online live chat room that takes place every day during the trading day that follows big money coming into the options market, which many times can help telegraph moves that will happen in the equities market. It's a strategy that Lucci has been perfecting and using for almost a decade now. It's a strategy that other trading services have now tried to adopt. But Lucci and his partner, Charlie Bathgate, are two of the OGs of using this type of options flow to help with their trading. So you can check out the Sanglucci Steam Room in the link in the podcast description. He also offers his Sanglucci Master Course, which is investor education, and the 3LT Playbook. If you just want a short, sweet three rules that Lucci has used to make himself a millionaire, this is the place to do it. Check out the 3LT Playbook. And if you get a chance, check out some of my podcasts with Lucci because he's a badass dude and I got no problem recommending his shit on the air, not only because he supports the podcast, but because he's a good friend. I consider him a friend. This podcast also brought to you by my very good friends over at RumorHound. RumorHound is another fantastic tool to having your toolkit if you're a day trader. RumorHound is an artificial intelligence-based piece of software that takes a look at merger and acquisition rumors, which you see them pop up every day on Twitter, in chat rooms, in your traders feed, all over the place, on TV. And it looks at the, well, actually what it does is it takes a bunch of proprietary variables, but it looks at things like whether or not the financials would make sense, like what the source is of the rumor, along with a multitude of other proprietary variables, puts it into their algorithm, and then spits out a recommendation to you as to whether or not a merger and acquisition rumor may be worth paying attention to or maybe not worth paying attention to. And as you know, money can be burned on M&A rumors that don't pan out, and money can be made on M&A rumors that wind up consummating. So this is what my friends at RumorHound have perfected. Check them out at rumorhound.ai, their link, and follow them on Twitter too because they hand out some freebies on Twitter. That link is also in my podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at Corvus Gold, my buddy Monero, my friend Jay Mintzmyer, the fantastic shipping analyst, my dear friend Russell Valenti, Nicholas Parks, my buddy Nathan Michaud over at Investors Underground, Chris Bede, who has been a longtime supporter of the podcast, along with Ken R. and Chris Boas. Thank you guys so much. One of my newest supporters, Crichton Titus, Ken, and J.K. Cunningham. Thank you guys so much. Thank Love and Brainerd Ferguson. And some of my newest patrons, people that have signed up of late, like Charles Magnan, Justin Roberts, Michael Johnson, Chris Wagner, my homeboy Want2XL is back in the house, Chris Hicks, Andrew Mars, still pulling for my homeboy Mike Fenderson too, brother. I haven't forgotten about you. How about some people that have been with me for a while too and we'll get this show on the road, like Erman Saul Wotan. Thank you for the emails, brother. Bite My Shiny is in the house. Gregory Hines is still here. Mason Bustle's still here. David Spots is still here. Reed Sherman, talk to you today, brother. Chris Bunting, Jack Burton, Jason Bernstein, thank you guys so much. I appreciate the continued support. One last one. How about endthefed.org? I remember you guys. All right, rules for today's podcast. We're about to get deep in some shit the way that we always do when we have the absolutely wonderful Whitney Webb on. So folks, get your mind limber. However you need to do that, whether it's you have a couple of drinks, whatever you do in the privacy of your own home is nobody's business but your own. Our recommendation on the podcast is a 2-drink minimum. Of course, 21 is the drinking age, so can't recommend that to you if you're under 21. But also, what you do in your own home is nobody's business but your own. I'll reemphasize that. Of course, and I will then again reemphasize, I don't advocate for breaking the law. Finally, this podcast is not life advice, investment advice, news advice. I don't consider myself a journalist. It should not be used as a source for anything. And ladies and gentlemen, I mean, even though the wonderful Whitney Webb happens to be a genius, I am not, folks. So we'll leave it at that. And that covers that. On the phone with me today, QTR podcast mainstay, one of my favorite independent journalists, award-winning journalist as well, Whitney Webb. Whitney Webb is a Mint Press news journalist. She's based out of Chile. She's contributed to several independent media outlets, including Global Research, EcoWatch, the Ron Paul Institute, and 21st Century Wire. She's made several radio and television appearances, and I see her on YouTube all the time now, so she's made a million podcast appearances other than mine. But don't listen to any of those. Those are all terrible, and this one's great. And is the 2019 winner of the Serena Shim Award for Uncompromising Integrity, an award that I will not be winning anytime soon. Hello, Miss Whitney Webb. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. It's great to be back.
I was just joking. People should listen to your other interviews. They're fascinating. I listen to them on YouTube as well. You've done quite a few of them, huh, of late?
Yeah, probably too many, but it's all right.
If you click through and you just put your name in there or you watch one, there's a whole, you know, a whole litany of them comes up on the right side of the screen. There's a whole ton of them. So good for you. You're getting your name out there, and I see your Twitter following is growing as well. It should be. So you've been certainly seems like you're getting a lot more attention to your work, which is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, it also comes with some drawbacks, I guess. The more recognition you get, the more flack you take, too. So, you know, it's all par for the course.
That is very true. You're 100% right about that. And that's something I've experienced firsthand, unfortunately. But, you know, you take the good with the bad and you push forward. So there's a lot going on in the world today. We have we had a little kerfuffle here with Iran over the last couple of days, and I know that it's something that you've...
Kerfuffle is the word you want to use for that?
You know why I said that? All right. I was watching Judge Judy yesterday, and she said it. That's why. my Yiddish is mostly, pre-industrial. But, so we've had a minor disagreement here with Iran, it seems. Something that I know that you've written about at length. And, I would love to get your take on what the hell is going on in the world right now.
Well, it's a really complex situation. There's a lot of stuff to unpack. Usually what I like to look for in sort of unpacking, you know, what really went down there is the stuff, the angles that were really undercovered. And one of the most undercovered aspects of all of the stuff, you know, leading up to the kerfuffle or whatever you want to call it, was actually the address of the Iraqi prime minister to Iraqi parliament. He was giving a speech and the video feed was cut off by this MP that some people, I haven't looked into this myself, so take it with a grain of salt. Some people claim that the person, the MP that cut off the video feed is associated with U.S. interests, but, you know, I can't verify that specifically. But anyway, the video feed was cut off.
When was this?
And the transcript. I forget the exact date, but it was after Soleimani was killed.
Okay.
The Iranian general. But it was before the sort of, you know, the response and the standoff and all of that. And what this guy said, he said a couple of things, and only, you know, a little bit of it has gotten coverage. He said that Soleimani had been invited. The reason he was in Baghdad was because he had been invited there to sort of engage in sort of, I guess you could call it, you know, it basically was diplomacy, right? He was asked to, you know, sort of deal with some sort of effort at de-escalation involving the Saudis with the approval of Trump. And he had been invited to Baghdad for that purpose and was going to meet with the prime minister the morning he was killed, basically, which, of course, complicates the situation even further. But the other stuff this guy said, the prime minister of Iraq said, was also really troubling. He claimed, for example, that Trump threatened to have him and the Iraqi minister of defense murdered. And, you know, you would think that given the media climate in the U.S., if Trump threatened to kill some sort of public figure abroad, you know, the media would be all over that.
Sure.
But they haven't covered this claim at all, and I think that's really odd. And the backstory to this that the prime minister gave was that, you know, there was a lot of behind the scenes disagreements between him and Trump that had to do with Iraqi oil, basically, and this oil deal that Iraq began to negotiate with China beginning in October that noticeably coincided with the sort of the embassy protests and things of that nature. And, you know, and allegedly the prime minister claimed that the U.S. to some extent was fomenting that as a way to pressure the Iraqi prime minister from pursuing negotiations with China. Because basically what this deal with China became, it's like an oil for reconstruction agreement where, you know, China gets a certain number of barrels of oil from Iraq in exchange for reconstructing their oil infrastructure and infrastructure in general. And Trump had offered to do the same, the reconstruction thing, but he wanted half of Iraq's oil revenue, which is not a great deal,
right?
You know, for Iraq. And so, you know, this guy rejected it, and, you know, he was apparently targeted for regime change, and apparently those threats became increasingly bellicose, according to, you know, the prime minister himself. You know, obviously some people say that, you know, the prime minister may just be trying to blame everything on Trump and what have you, but the fact that that these claims haven't gotten any coverage and sort of this you know, backstory of the oil and the whole scenario hasn't really been talked about, the China for the China in Iraq oil deal, also Iran's recent discovery of oil and larger oil and gas reserves. You know, a lot of that has sort of been left out of this. And another aspect that's more related to the Soleimani assassination is that actually in January of 2018, it was reported that the Trump administration in Israel came to an agreement whereby Israel was given a quote-unquote green light by the Trump administration to assassinate Soleimani, and that they had attempted to do this several times, but from that period up until recently, with the last allegedly foiled plot not working out as recently as this past October, when a lot of this other stuff that I just mentioned that the prime minister had brought up had started to unfold as well. I think that is pretty interesting and likely credible, that foiled October plot, because we also had, prior to that allegedly being foiled, the director of the Mossad, Yossi Cohen, was openly talking about Israel killing Soleimani. The reason Soleimani and the IRGC, the you know, that he was associated with in Iran, the reason that was allegedly labeled a terrorist group, Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, claimed that Trump had labeled that group and Soleimani as such at his behest, which is interesting because that actually created the legal justification to have him killed. Having him being labeled as a terrorist, and therefore it's okay for the U.S.
Right.
to conduct an attack on, you know, Iraqi soil, you know, a ostensibly sovereign nation, and sort of get around the international law aspect of the whole deal. And Iran, after the killing, claimed that Israel was involved. And there's also been some allegations of that. We do know that Israel and the U.S., the Trump administration specifically, not really the Obama administration so much, have worked very closely together on their Iran policy. Actually, when H.R. McMaster was the national security advisor, they created his equivalent in Israel, signed an agreement where they set up several, I think, four joint teams to work on different aspects of Iran policy, and that the U.S.'s Iran policy would be planned in conjunction with Israel from that time. And that, I think, was the end of 2017. So there's been a lot of you know, their role has sort of been left out. And because of the fallout following the killing of Soleimani, Israel's tried to distance itself, probably because it was very poorly received internationally. You know, a lot of allies that normally would support, war with Iran or a push towards confrontation were silent, including, Israel, Saudi Arabia, also several allies in Europe. Very not pleased with what transpired, and some of them even pulled out of the anti-ISIS coalition that the U.S. had in Iraq. That they, some troops went home from, I think, Sweden and some other places as well.
Just because Israel didn't say anything, though, doesn't mean that they disapproved of it. I mean,
I think they were pleased that he was killed, and, for sure, because they were trying to do it and were unable to. It's possible, too, that they, said, oh, we didn't get to do it, and the opportunity arose for Trump to do it, and, he did it. Something like that is totally possible. It's worth pointing out, too, that, the neocons, for example, because there are neocons, obviously, within the Trump administration. A lot of them sort of, they conflate Israel's national security interests with the U.S. national security interests. This is a thing that is, a tenet, really, of neoconservatism. If you look at neoconservatism, just as a movement and ideology as a whole, that is definitely something that you see time and again, not just with neocons now, but in the past as well. So to have that many people in the administration, the current administration, thinking that way, it's very possible that could have happened. It could have been viewed that, the killing of Soleimani could have been seen as a boon by these people that conflate, Israel and the U.S.'s national security mm-hmm. interests, not necessarily thinking about the America First policy that supposedly Trump was elected to enact. That's just how things are, I guess.
Well, certainly it wouldn't be surprising that if the stuff that you're saying about H.R. McMaster working with Israel and the Trump administration, I have very limited geopolitical knowledge. I don't follow this very closely. I just watch the main headlines that come across the Bloomberg terminal. But certainly it feels as though the Trump administration has had significantly more has gotten significantly closer with Israel than the Obama administration had.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
No, I'm agreeing with you. Absolutely.
That doesn't come as too much of a surprise. It's interesting, too. One of the things that they kind of touched on quickly in the mainstream media after the assassination. So first off, you would never know that the international community, we talked about Israel, but that the international community had really decried the killing of Soleimani based on at least the mainstream media that I've watched, number one. Number two, the other question that was brought up briefly after Soleimani was killed and then I never saw anything about again was what the hell was he doing in Baghdad, right?
Right. Well, I sort of mentioned this earlier. The Iraqi prime minister claimed that he had been invited to take part in sort of these negotiations that were pointing towards de-escalation, other words, diplomacy of some sort to sort of de-escalate the situation that was, involved the Saudis and had the Trump administration approval. And then because he didn't arrive in a military aircraft,
right.
He arrived in a civilian aircraft. And he was in a civilian convoy, from what I understand. He was also one of the other guys that was killed, the head of the PMU group in Iraq, was a very popular military leader in Iraq, and he was killed in his own country by the U.S., and that's been cited by several people as reasons for why, the Iraqis are really unhappy with the U.S. right now, not just because of, the nature of the strike and Soleimani being killed, but also, this guy who had played an instrumental role in defeating ISIS, an Iraqi that was instrumental in defeating ISIS in Iraq, was killed off as well. And he wasn't, this quote-unquote terrorist as labeled by, this designation that was, pushed through a few, I forget exactly when the designation was, but I think it was, like a year or two ago. But he, it was just really complicated. But obviously, the fact that he was there and he wasn't trying to hide that he was there and he was there, came in a civilian aircraft, was allegedly there for a diplomatic mission. I mean, that is very concerning that he would have been killed under those circumstances. It's very, very troubling. I think that the Trump administration was willing to, you know, use that sort of circumstance to kill someone.
Yeah, you think they lured him there? Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's the claim. That's the claim, that he was sort of lured there under false pretenses, right, and then killed off. And, you know, if you're trying to claim that you want peace with Iran and you want to de-escalate the situation, and then you do something like that, it looks very bad. It looks like you want war.
Sure. Yeah, that would be a twist in the tale, certainly, if that turned out to be true, if he was lured there under the pretense. And I do remember seeing scattered reports after, too, that he was there on some kind of diplomatic, I think they called them peace talks, even. And, you know, if the U.S. had the guiding hand in kind of making sure he was there at that time in that place and civilian aircraft, like you said, and then they use that opportunity to kill him, that would be... I don't know. Certainly that would be an interesting twist in the tale. Where do you think, I mean, we had this kind of limited retaliatory attack from Iran, and then there was some rockets that went off in the green zone in Baghdad yesterday. Trump supposedly now has said he you know, wants to de-escalate. Iran has supposedly said they want to de-escalate.
Right.
What do you think happens going forward?
Well, I don't think we're actually going to reach a de-escalation to the extent where, like, the problem goes away. I think what happened is that both sides are trying to buy time. That's what it looks like to me.
Okay.
I also think that Iran sort of wants to put this sort of in the diplomatic sphere for a little bit, because the U.S. has become increasingly isolated on the issue, and that works to their advantage. That would be, you know, my opinion on that. Also, you know, I feel like there's going to be things that happen going forward. There's a lot of risk for potential, like, false flags to try and drag stuff into war. What we're seeing right now, too, is this whole deal with the military aircraft, which is basically, you know, the MH17 crash all over again, but this time with Iran and Ukraine. Obviously, just given the circumstances, whatever investigation is conducted into that is going to be very controversial and very politicized. And, you know, even if an international watchdog offers to intervene, it will be hard to trust those results after what happened with the OPCW in Syria, where they were basically caught fabricating evidence to support the case for war in Syria, basically, or to support the justification for the U.S. bombing of Syria after an alleged chemical attack that turned out not to be a chemical attack, even by the OPCW's own scientists' findings. So, you know, that's the UN's chemical weapons watchdog. So what happens if another UN watchdog for the UN gets a hold of the black boxes and does something similar? You know, there's, you know, it's just such a, the environment in terms of information is just so untrustworthy from both sides, honestly, because right, we can't really take anyone's word for anything at this point. And everything, so many, you know, on both sides, and even in the international level with the UN and all of this, there's been, you know, so many people have been discredited or organizations, and, you know, everyone has their agenda and all of this stuff. It's really right, hard to know exactly what's going on there. The only thing we can really know is that whatever investigation takes place into what happened to that airplane, it's going to be weaponized for political gain on both sides. So I think, you know, now that we're already seeing that happening just a few days after we almost, you know, the U.S. almost basically went to war with Iran, you know, I think it's really troubling that we're already seeing, we're saying we're going to de-escalate, but we're pushing this narrative that they, you know, shot down this airliner and killed a bunch of people, weaponizing a tragedy. You know, you're saying you want to de-escalate, but you're also, you know, already putting pressure on the other side. To me, it doesn't look like it's good for de-escalation over the long term in any sense. And I think what Iran wants is to push the U.S. out of the Middle East entirely, push them out of Iraq, basically.
Right.
And other, you know, areas of the Middle East where they either have bases, because there are a lot of U.S. military bases that surround Iran. Remember that Iraq is on one side of Iran. On the other side, you have Afghanistan, which has a very large U.S. military presence. And you know, obviously, so I don't think Iran wants to continue with that, obviously. And if they can use this situation to their advantage and keep pushing by different means, covert means, diplomatic means, you know, whatever it is, you know, they will definitely do that. I think another thing that happened with Iran's retaliation too is I think it's really the first time in recent memory where a country has responded to military, you know, a military act or act of aggression by the U.S. And gotten away with it. Because they essentially responded, and then the U.S. didn't really do anything back. Remember, you know, Trump bombed Syria a couple of times, and Syria didn't respond, right? So, and we've seen other instances of this in the past as well. But Iran did something, and you know, basically put the ball in Trump's court, and he didn't push it further. There's a lot of different ways to unpack everything that's going on. I think it's very it's really complex, and I think more information is going to be coming out over time. But there are definitely the threat of war, I think, is still very real. There are people in the Trump administration specifically that don't only want regime change for political or economic or, you know, purposes like that, that they also have like this religious extremism aspect sort of coloring their view of the scenario. The main players in that regard would be Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, and Vice President Mike Pence, who both subscribe to a religious ideology, and that they've been very open about hastening the apocalypse, holy war with Iran, and a lot of other things that I've written about in I think a couple of months ago, called the Untold Story of the Rise of Christian Zionism or something like that, that, you know, basically unpacks where that ideology came from and how it affects, and how Mike Pompeo and Mike Pence have been really open about that with respect to Iran and Middle East policy in general. And I think that doesn't really get enough coverage. It gets some, but not enough, because essentially that means that these two very powerful individuals are viewing the situation from a non-rational perspective, and there's you know, a lot of lives in play here. Sure. You know, Iran alone has like a population of what, like 80 million, and so this is all being, you know, colored with this sort of, you know, apocalyptic mindset of, oh, we have to hasten the apocalypse by creating this war, and that is really dangerous and doesn't really get talked about very much.
Yeah, traditionally, hastening the apocalypse is not something that anybody looks forward to. You know, I think
except for extremist religious groups.
Right. That's a very good point.
For most people, right.
And I just want to go back and touch on a couple of things that you said, because, you know, I follow the markets very closely. And the interesting thing that happened here over the last couple of days that has really befuddled me is once Trump decided that he wasn't going to, you know, be a total reactionary when it came to the Iran retaliation, and he backed off the gas a little bit. And I don't know if you follow the markets, but that night after the Iran retaliation, you know, the Dow futures had plunged like 400 points. The market looked like it was going to get smacked the next day. And then when Trump decided to do nothing, and then in the morning, go ahead and say, "Hey, it's all good," or whatever he tweeted, you know, "no lives
all
were
is
lost."
Well.
Yeah, all is yeah. well, right? You know, the market came back and roared. And there's a couple schools of thought on it. You know, one is that he really doesn't want to start wars, that he, you know, he feels like he got the best of both worlds because he was able to go in and take out Soleimani without causing World War III, if he really thinks that's the case. The second is maybe he wants to, you know, kind of quell any type of volatility, not only with the markets, but really with, you know, his approval as president heading into the election. But certainly to me, it feels like, and I tweeted about this a couple days ago, that people that are coming in and buying the market here under the guise of, "Hey, everything's fine again, just like it was before Soleimani was killed," I think are vastly mistaken. I think the tone under the surface and the tension under the surface is certainly probably at levels that are higher than they've been probably in a decade between us and Iran, right? I mean, would you agree,
right.
or do you think I'm?
Yeah, no, I would definitely agree with the idea that it's mistaken to think that things are back to quote unquote normal. for sure, I definitely don't. I definitely don't agree with that. I think things are really unstable, actually. But I think what it did is it sort of revived sort of an illusion of normalcy.
Right.
And from what I understand, you know, I mean, the stock market. You know, I'm not a big. You know, I don't follow the markets regularly, but it's sort of, you know, a lot of this is in fantasy land, you know, the U.S. monetary policy in general. I mean, just yesterday, I think the Fed VP said our monetary policy is great right now, right. And all this stuff. I mean, you know, it's sort of, you know, just disconnected from reality in a big way. But as long as you can sort of maintain the illusion of normalcy, you can, you know, keep things going the way they are until, you know, there's some insurmountable obstacle that prevents it from doing so.
Well, that's a given.
Or something else, right?
That's a given. And that's kind of like, I mean, we talk about this all the time on this show, and me and you are in the same camp here when it comes to how ridiculous, you know, our monetary policy is and the way that the global economy in general is being run. But, you know, what I was talking about, you know, the swing in the futures here over the last 48 hours, kind of within the umbrella of accepting that, even though we both reject it wholly. But you're right. I mean, it is a crapshoot in general, because the foundation, the bedrock, is ultimately flawed. But, you know, unfortunately, we have to even put that aside at some points to have a discussion.
Right.
So one of the other things I wanted to ask you about was this Boeing plane that came down that you touched upon briefly. Just now, as I'm on the line with you, there's headlines crossing the wire that Canada has also come out and said that its intelligence indicates that it was mistakenly shot down. There were no Americans on board this flight, but there were something like 180 total people. There were Canadians. I think there were 60-something Canadians. There were, you know, 60-something Iranians, I believe, and then people from all over the globe. So, you know, that blood is on somebody's hands.
Right.
Despite nobody being killed in Iran's retaliation, ostensibly 180 people were killed as a result of Iran's retaliation. What's your analysis of what happened and kind of how that's going to be received going forward? Because there hasn't, look, you mentioned before you think there's going to be consequences on a global stage and people are going to go to shape the narrative. But even today, Whitney, as it's been breaking, it doesn't really feel like anybody is trying to use that or weaponize that, as you said earlier.
Well, I think if we listen to Trump's statement that he gave on all this the other day, one thing that was really clear is that he's not going to take like stronger action against Iran militarily in a situation like this unless he has more international backing.
Right.
We all know that Trump really hates NATO, but in that statement, he asked NATO to become more involved in the Middle East. That, to me, was a signal that we want international backing before getting into this all by ourselves at a time when, you know, the U.S. foreign policy has led it to be increasingly isolated. And a lot of that has to do with withdrawal from the Iran deal and also what's been going on with Iran more in the U.S. more recently. In terms of the headlines today, there were actually headlines yesterday, I think a story from The New York Times, saying that Western officials blamed a mechanical fault for this. Remember, this is a Boeing plane.
Right.
Boeing has been under a lot of controversy for problems with its aircrafts in general. And as this news was coming out, Boeing stock started to climb from what I saw. So, you know, we know that also that the Boeing CEO and Trump have had a very close relationship from the beginning of the administration. This could just be something as simple as that, or it could be, you know, weaponized in the future to try and get more international backing and support to, you know, target Iran further in the pursuit of administration goals for that specific policy. But I really think we don't have enough information. I know that Iran has claimed apparently that it will not be releasing the black boxes. But right. I mean, to who was asking for them? The U.S. I mean, obviously, if that was the case, you know, if you were Iran, why would you do that? after all that's happened recently, and as I mentioned earlier, you know, that this lack of trust in the you know, like the UN watchdogs and international watchdog organizations that would normally handle this type of investigation too, may have given them pause for that. But it's also very possible that there is, you know, damning information on those black box for Iran that they don't want publicly released.
Right.
Like I said, it's really hard to know exactly what's going on. And, everyone has their agenda here. It's hard to know who to trust. I think we'll just see. It's easier to sort of suss out what's going on going on potentially, you know, moving forward as they try and shape the narrative further. And, you know, we'll see what's going on from there. But from what I understand, that this New York Times article, it said Western intelligence agencies, you know, obviously it's a developing situation, but that they declined to think that the plane had been shot down. And now I think it was one or two unnamed officials cited in the report saying that it was in fact shot down. So, you know, when there's unnamed officials involved making claims and not providing evidence, you know, it's I tend to wait for the evidence, you know, before making a decision. Because, you know, unnamed intelligence officials saying stuff about the Middle East, I mean, why are we still believing them? you know what I mean? Like put your name out there and put out some evidence and say what agency you work for, you know, so people will actually believe you, because we've been led into disaster numerous times in the Middle East by just trusting unnamed intelligence officials or dubious intelligence that was never released to the public. And we just had to, you know, take their word for it. And a lot of those people were involved with that faulty intelligence are still around, and a lot of them run prominent Washington think tanks, or they are in the current administration,
or they're on the boards of directors of companies.
Well, of Raytheon, like Stephen Hadley.
Right, exactly. Well, there was video today that surfaced on social media that you know, was supposedly, allegedly, video of the plane being shot down. I certainly saw the stock's reaction to the news kind of each way. The interesting thing was that plane was a 737-800, which is a different plane that...
It is different.
That has been kind of embroiled in the Boeing controversy, which was the 737 MAX. So up front, you know, my initial take on the headline when it broke that night was either, you know, Boeing is completely toast, because if it is a mechanical failure on a different model, I mean, the company is just, I'm not sure they'll ever recover from that. That's a massive crisis for them. Massive. Certainly, it would be in Boeing's best interest if Iran did shoot down the plane. I certainly also saw the headline that Iran did not intend on releasing the black boxes. But it isn't inconceivable that it was shot down. I mean, you know, then I have a million other questions, right? Like, what the hell are 66 Canadians doing in Iraq flying to Ukraine? Like, I don't know. I'm sure there's a reasonable answer for that, right? But, like, here we go. Here's what just broke. Evidence indicates an Iranian missile brought down a Ukrainian passenger plane, and the strike may have been unintentional, according to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. So Trudeau is now out kind of pushing that line as well. Maybe he's got Boeing stock, right?
But did Canadian intelligence get that from U.S. intelligence? Because the U.S., the last I saw before, you know, I picked up the phone, was that the U.S. was claiming that you know, the specific missile model that was used, and they haven't examined the site, so it would be kind of hard for them to know, I would assume anyway. But you know, I'm just inherently really skeptical of these things. I think, you know, considering it's a very close relationship between Trump and Boeing. I mean, I think right after Trump was elected, there was some sort of, like, he tweeted about Boeing and he was like, lower your prices for our planes or whatever, something like that. But then after that, the Boeing CEO, got really close to Trump and built an increasingly close relationship. I've written some articles on this before, but a few years ago, and if there was, you know, like you said, another model, another plane suffered a mechanical fallout that resulted in a crash that killed every single passenger, like you said, Boeing is toast. What this would do would, you know, this narrative, if they don't push it further and they don't try and push for more sanctions or some sort of punishment for Iran, it's very possible that this narrative could have just been put out there to sort of rescue Boeing from total ruin. Boeing, remember, is a major U.S. defense contractor. Sure. It's not just involved in civilian aircraft. It's very involved with the U.S. military industrial complex. Its collapse would be very damaging. That complex at this time. It would also be, you know, damaging to, presume, you know, the U.S. economy. Also, you know, Trump, a cornerstone of his quote-unquote diplomacy has been to promote U.S. arm exports abroad. Obviously, having Boeing in a scandal or problems like this would affect that negatively. So it's really hard you know, there's definite motives for that, just like there's definite motives for Iran to, if it was shot down, not to release the black boxes.
Right.
But I think both deserve equal consideration until we have more evidence, and that people should stay away from trusting unnamed, you know, U.S. intelligence officials, because, you know, they could be anyone and they could be saying anything. Please stop trusting our intelligence agencies when they don't reveal their names and they don't reveal their evidence.
I think a majority of my listeners don't trust anybody at all, which is great.
Right. Okay. So we're in the same boat.
But just to take it back to Boeing again, you know, I have a friend of mine who is who I respect immensely, who's a fantastic investor, an exceptionally intelligent person, who I had this discussion with a couple of days ago. And, you know, he sent me a couple of messages basically saying, look, you know, I have friends in aviation, many of them, that think that the 737 MAX, which was the original plane here embroiled in controversy, will never fly again. And that's something that personally I don't think is out of the question. I mean, they keep trying to make repairs, they keep trying to make fixes, then they want to add the simulator, they want to do this, they want to do that. And it seems like around every corner that they turn, another problem with the 737
MAX. Right, they just found like two more failure, like potential flaws or something like that.
Right. So at
like
some
really recently,
at some point, if you're Boeing, you have to think, like, if we put this fucking thing back in operation, nobody's going to want to fly on it anyways. Even, you know, I've seen reports where airline stewardesses and, you know, people like that have said, we're never setting foot on one. Certainly the last 5, 6, 7 times I've flown, I've pulled the card out of the fucking seat in front of me for the first time ever and been like, I wonder what model plane I'm flying on, you know? So there's an argument. My friend wanted to make the argument, Whitney, that if the 737 MAX never flies again, you know, Boeing would essentially have to buy a bunch of those back, and Boeing would continue as a company, but its equity, meaning the people that have invested in the stock, it would likely be bailed out by the government, but the stock could get, essentially could get zeroed out, which would be an enormous drag on the Dow Jones. It's a major Dow component, number one. So the Dow Jones index, it has a lot of influence over the whether the Dow Jones index goes up or down. You know, but to your point, and my counterpoint to him was, it is so closely woven into the fabric of U.S. defense. It's not Lockheed Martin, but it's not far off. Boeing and the U.S. government are very, very tight. And many people, I think, believe Boeing to kind of be indestructible, which is why I think the stock isn't 120 points lower from where it is now. So the question then, Whitney, is, you know, the question really is, what the hell happens, right? There's so much riding on it. And Boeing, we know, is never going to go away, right? But there's so much riding on Boeing stock, too. I mean, it's...
Right. Well, if you're linking this also to, like, the performance of the stock market in general, that it would have a major impact on the stock market in general if Boeing were to get zeroed out.
Oh, it definitely would.
It's important to point out, too, that President Trump often links... only really uses the stock market as like his indicator of like how good the economy is doing under his presidency. And so when the stock market is doing bad, he gets stressed out. And he's already under all this duress, I guess you could say, from the fallout from the Soleimani killing and all of the stuff that's happened since. And, you know, he has all this other domestic flack from like the Democrats, the impeachment stuff, all that. Like the last thing he needs is, you know, his greatest ally, honestly, in the military industrial complex, Boeing, that's the CEO he's closest to lose him, you know, or not necessarily lose him, but like, you know, he would drop in prestige, that CEO, if Boeing were to tank.
Yeah, and ostensibly
have economic problems. So just imagine what the scenario would be that, you know, if it was a mechanical problem and it was admitted as such, what would be the consequences? And if these, you know, if all these people, you know, these intelligence officials, whatever, were thinking about the consequences and they didn't like that and they wanted to avoid it and feel like they could put pressure on Iran at the same time, would they do it? Probably yes. but again, I'm not saying that's possible, but I think it should definitely be considered. And also I am a little terrified now after this to ever go on a Boeing plane ever again.
Yeah. And I mean, one thing I think you and I can both agree on is the story we're going to be given is likely not going to be 100% the truth. And, you know, I'm not basing that on
from
any.
Either side.
What's that?
From either side.
Correct. Yeah, correct. Mm-hmm. And what will be widely accepted, I think, too, what, you know, whatever is deduced by the mainstream media as quote unquote, like the story, like, all right, here's what's going to happen. Here's the AP headline. Here's the Reuters headline. That story is likely not 100% going to be the truth. The only question is how far it deviates from the truth. Did you see the video of the wreckage today?
No, I haven't seen the video.
Yeah, so I'd be interested in your thoughts on that as
but
well.
But is it official or unofficial?
It looked pretty official. I think it was actually RT that was airing the video from what was supposedly the crash site in Iran. And there's been several videos of this, but you know, you can clearly make out the engine. You can clearly make out parts of the fuselage. You can, you know, clearly make out there were a couple like the children stuffed animals. And I know somebody had reported a couple of days ago, you know, there were body parts everywhere, which, I mean, to me, that seems, if we're to be believed, that seems more conducive with a strike in midair versus the plane kind of nosediving into the ground on its own due to a mechanical failure, assuming those videos are correct.
Right. I haven't seen the videos, and I'm also like not I don't do like analysis of crash sites or like missile strikes or anything like that. So I am not. I'm just going to stay straight up. I'm not the person to ask to analyze those videos and tell people what to think. I can just only really talk about, you know, sort of the implications of what, you know, what we've already discussed. That's pretty much the extent of what I can really say on it.
Yeah, well, I'm not a crash
analyst.
I'll
take a look at the videos and I'll see, but I mean, it's hard to know. Also, like videos can be fudged a lot these days. There's all, you know, it's hard to know if it actually was from the crash site, where it was obtained from. You know, there's a lot writing on this apparently, you know, as we've discussed. So, you know, it's, it could really go either way. I'm just ridiculously skeptical about all this stuff right now and super like still like strung out from, there was almost a war, you know? So I'm, just trying to get over that still even.
Yeah, and that hasn't quite gone away yet either, unfortunately. And also, you know, look, I'm not a crash site analyst either. I give a nice disclaimer at the beginning of this podcast, which is, hey, you know, we're just pretty much talking some shit here. So I hope... Oh, did I lose you? Are you still there, Whitney? Oh, I may have lost you for a second. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm back.
Okay,
I didn't hear
I'm
what you
sorry.
Said. Sorry.
I was just saying, hey, like... You know, you don't have to prime my listeners by saying, oh, I'm not a crash site analyst, even though, you know, I understand why you're doing it. You know, we have a good forum here to just have it like an open discussion. I'm certainly not an analyst on those things either. I appreciate you doing that. You know, but we're just trying to apply some common sense. And I think your overall tone of what I would say is harsh skepticism, I think is warranted, just given the history of everything that's ever happened.
Right.
So the other thing I wanted to talk to you about briefly, if we can move on from this, is some of the other work that you've been doing of late with Israeli intelligence. I was wondering if you could just touch on, you know, some of your more recent pieces, kind of give my listeners a primer if they want to go start digging into some of your recent reporting, what they will what they'll find.
Okay, so the reason I got interested in the story that I just put out, it was going to be a two, but now it's a three-part series. It started because in November, there was an election simulation that was reported on by a handful of mainstream outlets, but it was a very bizarre simulation. So, you know, it was a simulation of like the 2020 election day. And, you know, the reason behind it was like, oh, because there was, you know, all this meddling in 2016, we had to do a simulation about how to protect democracy. But if you remember back, right, the alleged, you know, extent of the interference parents was like social media manipulation, like $100,000 in ads, 25% of them were never seen by anyone. Like, it really, you know, it was stuff like that. And then the Wiki, you know, claims that WikiLeaks was colluding with a foreign actor and the emails and the leaked emails and all this stuff, right? So anyway, this election simulation considering what the alleged meddling before, it was complete overkill. Basically, what the simulation was putting a team of law enforcement from FBI, the Secret Service, and DHS against a group of bad, quote unquote, bad actors, right? Bad guys, whatever you want to call them. And the election simulation ended with 32 dead, 200 injured. This was just focusing on a town, like, or a state, maybe something pretty small and local, you know, for Election Day 2020. And it was 32 killed, 200 injured. Martial law declared and the elections canceled. So basically what this bad actor team did was stuff like take control of cars, crash them into people waiting in line at polling stations, release all these deep fakes all over social media, hack TV channels, tell people polling stations were closed when they were actually open, giving all this misleading information, deep fakes of one of the main candidates for president, having he or she say something they didn't really say, you know, and just creating this extreme chaos that has never been experienced on any election day ever in the history of the U.S. And the alleged reason for this was, oh, we have to avoid the failure of imagination, just like what happened on 9/11. You know, 9/11, the official reason for why they couldn't prevent the attack was, we didn't expect them to fly planes into buildings, even though a year before 9/11, there was a simulation of planes being, you know, right, rammed into the Pentagon. But anyway, that the official story is otherwise. So that was the claim here. And I thought it was really creepy that FBI, DHS, and the Secret Service were all part of this election simulation that ended with martial law being declared and the elections being canceled. I thought, well, that's creepy. And then I realized that this was not a federal simulation. It was organized by a private company, a private cybersecurity company that did this for free, the simulation for free, but they don't offer any software that could have prevented any of the attacks that were carried out in that simulation. They do like antivirus and protection from ransomware attacks and things like that. And this simulation didn't involve voting machines, electronic voting machines, or anything like that at all. It was all about like messing with people's minds and basically terrorism. I mean, if you're ramming cars into civilians standing to wait in line and vote, I mean, right, that's a terrorist attack.
Sure.
Right. So, you know, nothing this company, there's no financial incentive for them to do this simulation, have it end like that, and then be like, oh, hey, buy our product and right, we'll prevent this from happening.
Right.
That wasn't a factor here, and that was really odd. And then I started to look into this company, and there were a lot of ties over to the company that I wrote about in a follow-up to my Epstein reporting, which was about this 911 call center technology company that had been funded in part by Jeffrey Epstein and was also co-founded by Ehud Barak and had a lot of creepy things going on there that we talked about, I think, the last time I was on. So anyway, a lot of those same actors are actually involved with this company. This company is called Cyber Reason. It is based in Boston, was first founded in Tel Aviv by former members of Israel's Unit 8200. Unit 8200 is most often described as Israel's equivalent of the NSA. They're involved in signals intelligence surveillance. They also are involved in blackmail. They're involved in offensive hacking operations and defensive hacking operations as well. So basically the guy that founded this company, his name, there's three co-founders that were all part of this unit. The current CEO, a guy named Lior Div, was in charge of one of the Unit 8200 units that were involved in the largest cyber offensive hacking operations against nation states. So that was what he did while he was there. After that, he went and worked at Amdocs, which is a very controversial company that was involved in U.S. Basically spying on U.S. Federal agencies on behalf of Israel. There's a very important report that was done by Carl Cameron of Fox News in 2001 that I recommend that everyone watch, that talks about Amdocs and Converse Infosys, which is now called Verint. And the other two co-founders of this company, Cyber Reason, worked for subsidiaries of Verint before this company was founded. Anyway, going back to the CEO, after he did his stint at Amdocs, he founded a company that was claims to be involved in recruiting and corporate headhunting, but actually in Israeli media reports, it says it's a contractor for cybersecurity for the Israeli government. And then in 2012, he teams up with these other guys and founds Cyber Reason. And then he openly has stated in media reports about Cyber Reason and its its growth as a company and its activities, that he views his work at Cyber Reason as a continuation of his service to Unit 8200. In other words, Israeli military intelligence, which is a little concerning considering the type of simulations that they are involved in with the election system. But what's also odd, in the article that I put out, I only really go over all the different ties to intelligence that this company has, because it's not just Israeli military intelligence. They're also very involved with the CIA. One of their main advisors is a guy named Robert Bigman, who was the CISO of the CIA for, like, I think over almost two decades, and was with the CIA for 30 years. He's also on the board of directors of a company, the CIA guy, called Sepio Systems, whose chairman of the board is Tamer Pardo, the former director of Mossad. So it's sort of like this, what I would say about this company and other companies like this is that it's sort of a push towards a binational security state, whereby the Israeli military-industrial complex and the U.S. military-industrial complex are sort of fusing. And we're also seeing this on with the tech sector as well, with cybersecurity, because actually a lot of defense contractors in the U.S. have a large IT division as well. And so we're seeing a lot of, these companies like Cyber Reason become very involved in that. And Cyber Reason specifically, one of their main investors is Lockheed Martin, that poured $25 million into this company and ended up partnering with them. And pretty much every Lockheed Martin computer runs their software, and their software, they also have all their software run anywhere Lockheed Martin's IT service is offered. They automatically have Cyber Reason integrated into their product portfolio. But Lockheed Martin, they spun off their IT division and into Leidos, which is another, I think, the biggest provider of IT to the federal government. So Cyber Reason software, this super intelligence connected company, is running on pretty much a very large number of government computers, for companies that contract for the NSA, the CIA, the Army, the Navy, pretty much every branch of the military. Very, very troubling, considering that this is a foreign, foreign intelligence connected company that also has, connections to domestic intelligence, but principally to a foreign company. And now they're doing these rather odd simulations with the elections. I think it should be talked about a little more. But it's not just that I'm picking on Israel either. I am saying this because there is a history, as I talked about in my Epstein series, of intelligence, specifically Israel, putting backdoors in software and then marketing it to sensitive U.S. laboratories and in other locations. For example, I talked to, on the program before, I talked about the Promise software, which was this software that was stolen from Inslaw Inc. By the Justice Department and then passed by Israel, and that the CIA had a version with its backdoor and Israel had a version with its backdoor, and then both were marketed widely all over the world. And so these intelligence agencies had backdoors into all the data of massive banks and financial institutions, governments around the world, and intelligence agencies around the world. And Robert Maxwell, Ghislaine Maxwell's father, was one of the marketers of this, and he sold the Israeli backdoored software to Los Alamos Laboratory in the U.S. and several other sensitive locations in the U.S., and that was used as a backdoor by Israeli intelligence. Also, the company that this Cyber Reason's CEO used to work for, Amdocs, they tapped the White House lines And that's how Netanyahu was the first person to have the calls of Clinton and Monica Lewinsky together and attempted to use that as leverage over Clinton. You know, I think the year was 1999. I'd have to go back and look at my report to remember correctly.
Yeah.
But, there's a Newsweek, there's also several Newsweek reports. I think most of them are from 2014 that when the Snowden leaks happened, there was a document within the Snowden leaks that listed Israel as the most aggressive spy agency targeting the U.S. behind Russia and China. Number three, meaning that they are more aggressive in terms of espionage and cyber hacking and all this stuff against the U.S. than Iran, that we almost just went to war with them, right? So Israel's number three on there, and we're letting a company, you know, like that on all these government computers, and they're using Lockheed Martin as a conduit. Interestingly enough, Lockheed Martin invested in this company right after they opened an office. They created a subsidiary called Lockheed Martin Israel, right in this area, the IDF cyber hub, it's called, in Beersheba in the Negev Desert. And basically you have all interconnected, a high-tech corporate park, the IDF's like cyber units are located there. And then you also have, I forget the exact name of the agency, but it's like a cyber directorate of the government that's under the direct control of the Prime Minister of Israel. So you basically have this public-private partnership between the Israeli intelligence and government, and you know, the public sector, but intelligence is also very involved, and a lot of these high-tech startups that are coming out of Israel. And this is openly admitted in Israeli media. This is also there's actually an article about it in Foreign Policy that, you know, openly admits it as well and talks about how this is a public-private partnership. It's really almost impossible to know where a company, how much that it colludes with the government, because they're so intertwined to a significant degree. And what's really interesting about this too is that a lot of the technologies that were weaponized in this election simulation, like deepfakes, for example. Well, the main company making deepfakes is a company called Canny AI that is an Israeli company. They've gotten a lot of coverage recently because they did a deepfake of Richard Nixon. They did one of Mark Zuckerberg and a couple others. They generate a lot of media publicity. But if you look at their funding, 100% of their funding comes from this startup called Accelerator, which is funded by Shin Bet, which is basically Israel's FBI. It's a domestic intelligence agency, and they are partnered with Cyber Reason. That seems weird.
Yeah, it certainly does. And a lot of this, the broader scope of this, I remember we discussed at length the last time that you were on. So if you're listening and you kind of want to go back and even dive into this a little bit more, that was podcast number 146 from September 14th of last year. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I thought there was a break there, but please continue.
No, it's fine. So there's a lot of moving parts to this, and it's really hard to know, like, why are they so interested in the elections? But a lot of it just looks really out of place, and given how that simulation just turned out, a very uncomfortable feeling. And so I was looking for conflicts of interest there beyond just the Israeli military intelligence angle. And it turns out that their largest investor is SoftBank, which I thought was kind of interesting as well, because SoftBank had a lot of connections to it does have connections to Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince of the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, who was, he's the main investor in SoftBank's Vision Fund. Right. And then you also have the UAE in there. And then you also have Jared Kushner has ties to SoftBank. And we also know that essentially SoftBank bailed out WeWork and allowed Adam Neumann to walk with a bunch of money. Adam Neumann came out after this and said that he worked with Kushner and MBS, or Mohammed bin Salman, on the Middle East peace deal. And the three of them together were going to save the world and all this stuff. Christ. So in SoftBank. Right. And SoftBank, we also know, has ties to the Trump administration. I think the head of SoftBank, what's his name? Masayoshi-san.
Masayoshi-san,
like,
yeah.
Right, yeah. So he had a meeting at Trump Tower, and he said SoftBank was going to invest all this money in the U.S. And he actually followed Trump to Saudi Arabia when Trump was visiting there to announce the inauguration of the Vision Fund, SoftBank's Vision Fund, and all this stuff. So there's you know, their main investor has some ties to the current administration. I think that's kind of you know, troubling. You know, in authoritarian governments like MBS, that's just not a great look. So, you know, I just want people to look at this information. I want to get it out there. I don't really want anyone, I don't want to tell anyone what to think about it, because it's a controversial topic. Sure. It's creepy stuff. But I was looking at this and I was like, do I just let this go unreported, or do I just inform people and let them make their own conclusions? You know, the facts are there. I would encourage people to look at them and consider how they feel about this. It makes me very uncomfortable, the fact that there is a company basically gauging how our law enforcement reacts to these type of events on election day. It makes me really uncomfortable. I don't care. You know, before I even knew the company was Israeli, as I explained earlier, you know, I was really uncomfortable with that simulation, as I think any American would be.
Sure.
Right. So the more you look at this, the more troubling it honestly becomes. What do we do about it? I don't know. I just think the information needs to be out there, and people need to take a long, hard look at this. And it deserves some scrutiny.
Well, you know, we're libertarians here, so we don't ever try to tell people what to think. I think it's a great way to put this stuff out there, just saying, like, here's the facts, and you guys think about it the way that you want. What I'll tell you personally is, of course, I have not looked at this or done any research on this in the way that you have. I've done very little. I've just, aside from precursory looks and what we've talked about today. But some of the things that you're bringing up, like the idea of backdoors in software, when you know we rely on software from overseas for almost everything, you know, those right. types of things
and this company,
very frightening.
Sorry to interrupt you.
It's okay.
But Cyber Reason, as I said earlier, it does antivirus. It does it manages endpoints for all these companies. And it's not just government. It's not just on government computers. It's like tons of Fortune 500 companies now use this software. But there's a lot of experts that have been quoted on you know, other matters, not talking about this company specifically, but about the you know, how this type of technology is weaponized by intelligence services around the world. And they always say that, a lot of these analysts have said that antivirus is the ultimate backdoor, because it basically you have to have
right.
access to all the, you know, all the components of the computer to protect it, right? So you can basically have access to, you know, all these databases. And it's just very troubling that this is on NSA, CIA, military computers. And it's so clearly tied to foreign intelligence that, you know, the CEO openly admits that he views his work there as a continuation of his time in
right.
Unit 8200.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a huge red flag to me. And also all the media coverage that I mentioned earlier of this election simulation did not mention that this company was foreign. It did not mention that it's all of its co-founders were part of this military intelligence unit of a foreign country. It didn't really talk about the company at all. And it was basically like, thank goodness this company is doing this. Aren't they great guys?
Right.
I find that narrative to be also unsettling. Considering, you know, the stuff I've mentioned before. But this is actually something that has been going on for a while. And I mentioned this a little bit before about this sort of binational security state. I just want to give some more examples of that. So the
sure.
former NSA director, Mike Rogers, was recently hired by Team 8, which is a Unit 8200 startup accelerator that's run by the former commander of that unit. And he was hired, after he was hired, these guys from the NSA spoke out, I think, to CyberScoop and some other outlets, and they said that the reason Mike Rogers was hired by Team 8 was because of his knowledge of U.S. covert operations in the field of cyber and how the infrastructure is set up at the U.S. That is really freaky. he has now been hired by this company to advise them about what types of startups to create and fund and what type of technology for them to produce. I also would like to point out that the NSA under Keith Alexander, who I believe preceded, was the one immediately before Mike Rogers, he oversaw the giving of contracts to the company I mentioned earlier, Converse InfoSense, now Verint, to create backdoors into the telecommunication system for the NSA. So basically, this foreign company created, on behalf of the NSA, backdoors into all of the U.S. telecommunication system, and also into Android phones, Facebook, and like in social media and all of this stuff on behalf of the NSA. And to think that this company, Verint, which was also founded by Unit 8200 guys, and their CEO was like arrested for fraud in money laundering and a bunch of other crimes in like wanted in the U.S. for years and eventually arrested in like 2016. They were given the contract to do this, and I think it's really naive to think that they would not have kept those back doors for themselves. There was also the story that came out recently. Some people may remember it. It was quite I think it was pretty much memory hold at this point, but there were all these Stingray devices, spying devices found around the White House, I think just a few months ago, and that intelligence officials in the U.S. said that they were being used by Israel to spy on the White House. Look it up.
Say that one more time, too, because you cut out. I just want to get it on the record.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. There was a story a few months ago. I forget how many months ago, so excuse me for that. But no there problem. There were these Stingray spying devices, these surveillance devices that were uncovered surrounding the White House, basically spying on White House communications. And U.S. officials said that it was being run by Israel. Trump was asked what he thought about it, and he said he didn't believe the reports. Yeah. Netanyahu denied it, and then that's where the story – that's just where the story went. I just went from there. I also want to remind people too, please look at my Epstein reporting. I make the claim that Epstein worked for multiple intelligence agencies over his career, but the evidence shows, at least from my research, that his sexual blackmail operation was being run at the behest of Israeli military intelligence, right? Blackmailing politicians for these same people that are running these election simulations. It is very creepy. Is this really our greatest ally? I think the question needs to be asked. People just need to look at the evidence. A lot of times people, you know, say that I harp on Israel a lot, but what I try and do in my work is try and cover things that don't get covered or that get memory hold. A lot of people are afraid to cover issues related to Israeli military intelligence or Israeli intelligence in general. And actually, most of the pushback I have gotten for my Epstein reporting has been about mentioning that there were, in fact, ties between Epstein and Israel. And actually, since I did that reporting and got the flack for that, Stephen Hoffenberg, who was Epstein's one of his close business associates from 1987 to 1993, went on the record I think maybe a couple weeks ago saying that Epstein admitted to him that he was working for multiple intelligence agencies, including the Israelis, and this was before he set up that sexual blackmail operation, which appeared to have begun in 1994 and 1995, right? And as I mentioned earlier, he funded another company just like this, Unit 8200, a founded company that is chaired by Ehud Barak, the former prime minister of Israel, former head of Israeli military intelligence, who was good friends with Epstein. Epstein poured $1 million into that company. Epstein, before he was arrested, was trying to rebrand as a tech investor. He had cultivated ties with a bunch of Silicon Valley companies. People need to be looking at this as part of the bigger picture as well, in light of my recent reports, because that's what I'm doing. It's hard for me to sort of lay out this bigger picture in a report and have it be like understandable, but keep this stuff in mind. I mean, this is creepy stuff, and especially at a time when we are, you know, there are forces pushing us and towards conflict with Iran. A lot of them are neoconservatives. A lot of them, are coming from a foreign government as well, not just Israel, also Saudi Arabia and some other places, right? But it is important to consider, what would Israeli military intelligence do with that sort of leverage? It's a military. It wants to fulfill military objectives. There is a 60 Minutes report where Meir Dagan, the now deceased former head of the Mossad, went on and basically said that he wanted to try and not make the conflict with Iran an Israeli-Iran issue, make it an international issue by getting the U.S. involved. This is all out there. Please look up that interview, 60 Minutes, Mayor Dagan. You can find it.
Yeah, definitely.
And this stuff is part of the bigger picture, especially in light of what is going on right now. I think it is very important, and it is not being talked about.
How do my listeners follow you again? If this is the first time that you've listened to Whitney, first off, you know, welcome down the fucking rabbit hole, number one. Number two, check out the prior podcast, because you do talk a lot about those Israeli companies in the prior one. And also we talked about Epstein quite a bit. So if you're interested in that reporting, that's on the two prior podcasts we've done. But where do people find your reporting online, and where is your Twitter account?
Okay, so my Twitter handle is _WhitneyWeb. You can follow me there. I have a Facebook page, but I've been in like Facebook jail since like last April. They like won't let me post my articles.
So you get for telling the truth.
Yeah, right. So you can follow me, but I can't really post anything there. So I mean, if you want to do that, I guess you can go ahead. I just set up a Patreon because I'm actually writing a book on Epstein. I have a second series on Epstein coming out. I hope to start it in February. It's going to be focusing on why I actually think he was arrested at the time he was arrested. It didn't have to do with the sexual blackmail operation. It had to do with financial stuff that Epstein was involved in. A lot of his work in the world of shadow finance and money laundering, things like that. So your listeners will probably be very interested in that once it comes out. But I need some help, supplementing my income so I can hire a part-time research assistant. And, you know, I have a toddler, so I have to hire someone to take care of her so I can write and all of that. So if anyone's interested in helping me pursue my book on Epstein, which will combine this new series and the old series, that would be awesome. If you want to look at my written work that's coming out in the meantime, I publish exclusively at mintpressnews.com. And yeah, that's about it.
Cool. And I will put I'll put links to all your stuff in the podcast description as well. And that book is undoubtedly going to become a New York Times bestseller. I can tell you right off the bat.
I don't know about that, but I hope people buy it and read it.
people want the story. They want answers. It's so like when it bleeds over to the point where fucking Ricky Gervais is making a joke about it at the Golden Globes. Like, it's that obvious. It has gotten to a point of bludgeoning the public with how obvious it is that there's so much more here under the surface with this story. And I think people are starved and thirsty for the truth. So I really look forward to that project. And hopefully we can talk about it again in a couple months.
All right. Sounds good.
Thanks. You so much, Whitney Webb. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thanks again.
All right. Talk to you soon. That was the one, the only, Whitney Webb, one of the last great journalists on earth. Folks, if you get put in Facebook jail, you're doing something right. That's all you need to know. Now we know why she operates from the underground in Chile. But please check out all of Whitney Webb's fantastic stuff and check out our last couple of podcasts if you're interested in the subject matter a little bit further. But for right now, I have an awesome slate coming up for January that I'm so stoked about. Thank you guys so much for your continued Patreons. But for right now, I gotta go. All right, peace!